Happy Friday to all of you. I don't know about you, but I needed Friday this week. It's been a long week. It's been a cold week. And I need a good just weekend chilling on the couch. I think that's what I'm going to do this weekend. Although we're having Friendsgiving. My friends and I usually do an annual Friendsgiving. And so we're going to do that on Sunday, which is always a lot of fun. All right, a few things to get to today. On Fridays with Friends, I'm going to play more of an interview I did, a long format interview with 22-year-old Washington State Senator Simon Sefcik, who recently lost his bid to keep that spot. Remember, he'd been appointed to it, had to run for an actual election. He lost by just like 1,000 votes. But before he leaves his position in the state capitol in Olympia, I wanted to talk to him about kind of the next generation, about his generation, Generation Z, and where their politics are at, where their enthusiasm is at. And also, in the segment I'm going to play today, whether they might have kind of an independent streak, dare I say, a libertarian streak. So we'll have that towards the end of the show on Fridays with Friends. Also, back to Florida Report today. We're going to be talking about how Republicans in Florida are considering changing their state law so that if Ron DeSantis runs for president in 2024, he can still keep his job as governor in the meantime. Plus, Elon Musk is saying, and he teased today earlier on Twitter, that they are in fact going to release their internal deliberations about why Twitter spiked a New York Post story before the 2020 election on Hunter Biden's laptop, a story the mainstream media has now confirmed to be true all these years later. We will get to what Elon Musk has announced thus far. And I will say, at the time of this recording, I fixed my clock back there, which you guys have been complaining was out of batteries. I never put batteries in it. And now you get to see what time I actually tape the show. So these words are coming out of my mouth at like 2:30 p.m. Elon Musk was supposed to drop all this Hunter Biden laptop information at 2. He's a half hour late. You can't be late on something like that, Elon. You can't tease an announcement that big and then be late on it. So I'm going to hold off for a minute on discussing that story to give Elon Musk time to tell us what he's got. But first, I want to start the show with a little bit of a call to action today. Monday is a really big day in Washington State. You know, I know a lot of us look forward to the next legislative session, us political nerdy types, and we want to know, okay, what bills are they going to prioritize? But in truth, we can find out much earlier than January what kind of bills they're going to prioritize. Starting Monday, December 5th, you're going to start to see bills pre-filed. That's the earliest that Democrats and Republicans can start to drop bills that they are going to or try to introduce in the upcoming legislative session. And why that's a call to action is what we've seen over the years and the disastrous 2021 police reform efforts, police reform in air quotes, what happened with those is there was so much momentum before public pushback really began. And that was the mistake. And once the echo chamber in Olympia really got revving, there was just no undoing it. And we cannot make that mistake. 2022, the legislative session, there was a really good example of what can happen when you speak out early and often against terrible bills. So after the police reform stuff happened in 2021, it was like before a lot of us really knew what was happening, it was done. And we all know the impacts of those police reform pieces of legislation. It's been disastrous. So in about a year ago, December of 2021, Daniel, a very astute, undivided subscriber, alerted me to a bill that had been pre-filed just a couple days before Christmas last year. And of course, who's paying attention to pre-filed bills except you, Daniel, in the state legislature before Christmas? And part of me wonders if it was strategic to pre-file it then when everybody was distracted, because you guys will remember this bill. It was House Bill 1692, and it was a proposal from Democrats that would have reduced the penalty for drive-by shooters who kill someone. Remember this? We had just launched the Undivided podcast. In fact, I went and looked. This was, I talked about it on episode 16 of Undivided. That's how early on this happened. So Daniel points out this bill a couple days before Christmas, and I thought, you have to be kidding me. We have record homicide rates, record shooting rates, a big chunk of the state dealing with a serious gang violence issue, and you want to propose a bill that would make it so that drive-by shooting is no longer an aggravating factor in murder cases. meaning if it's an aggravating factor, it means the only option if you're convicted is life without the possibility of parole. So if you commit a drive-by and you shoot and kill someone, you're going to prison for life and you're going to die there. And I think that's very appropriate because how many instances have we had of drive-by shootings where an innocent person, I did a story on a one-year-old who was shot in the head and killed in a drive-by, in a car seat, in the back of their parents' car. So I'm sorry, when you open fire, you have a disregard for human life that means to me that you cannot live among the general population. So what we did December, this time last year, is we raised holy hell about House Bill 1692 every single opportunity we got from December to the legislative session. And by the time the legislative session got there, that bill was so hot, that bill was so controversial that it was even too much for Democrats. And it didn't even get off the ground. And so what we did and what I did on the podcast is as soon as I found out about it, I put something out about it. The next episode of the podcast, episode 16, we did a segment on it called What About Corey? Because the sponsor of this particular bill was Tara Simmons, who is herself a formerly incarcerated person. She has a really remarkable story, but she tends to focus on criminal justice issues. Her justification for the bill was a man named Kamonte Carter, who was serving life without parole for a drive-by shooting in 1997 that he had committed at just the age of 18. And she says, look, he's turned his life around. He shouldn't have to die in prison for something he did when he was 18. But what she failed to mention in putting the bill out there is the 19-year-old who Kamonte Carter killed. His name was Corey Pittman. He was back home on summer break from Alabama State University when Kamonte Carter fired about 19 rounds into his vehicle, mistaking him for a rival gang member, and killed him. So what I did when I found out about it, I reached out to try to find family members of Corey Pittman, and I found his brother, who still lived in the Tacoma area, Damian. And so I got a hold of Damian, let him know what was going on. He hadn't even heard about this bill. Nobody reached out to him to ask if he thought it was a good idea. He didn't. He was very distraught. So Damian joined the show, did a really emotional interview about his brother Corey and losing what it was like to lose his brother at such a young age. And then Damian went out on his own with his family. They contacted the media to be sure that their side of the story was heard on this early. He was reaching out to lawmakers, asking for conversations with lawmakers. We talked about this bill, proposed bill on the podcast, I think every episode leading up to the legislative session, and to try to broaden the scope of who we were informing about this horrible idea. I penned an op-ed for the Seattle Times that they published at the end of December. And so we really did not relent from the moment before Christmas that an undivided subscriber spotted this to the moment that it was clear that this bill was dead on arrival and that it wasn't going to get committee hearings from Democrats. And so that's, with that in mind, that's what needs to be done this year. So starting Monday, I'm going to include a link in this episode where you can monitor pre-filed bills. And the second they're dropped, if there is a bad bill in the bunch, we're raising holy hell about it. And we are not going to relent until the bill dies, okay? That is going to be our mission every December, as long as I do this job, to make sure that what happened in 2021 in this state does not happen again. That bad bills don't get so far until there's pushback over them. So that's my request from you, that you, when you spot a bill, it could be a bill you don't like that I do, I don't care. When you spot a bill that you have concerns over, reach out to your elected leaders, post about it on social media, raise awareness for it, reach out to the media, send them a link to it saying, hey, have you seen this? That's how, like I said, Daniel, an undivided subscriber, I don't even know if that bill would have passed had we not found out about it so early and raised so much hell about it. So that is my assignment and my call to action to you. Be on the lookout starting Monday. Those bills will trickle in from Monday through the end of the month and into early January before the legislative session starts. But absolutely, and if you spot one that you think needs to be talked about, send it to me, and we will certainly talk about any misguided bills as early as we possibly can. Wednesday on the subscriber-only show, I played a segment of an interview that I taped as part of my partnership with Future 42 with 22-year-old State Senator Simon Sefcik. We've had him on the show before, but so Simon was appointed to fill a vacancy in the Washington State Senate that came up when a former state senator, Doug Erickson, passed away after a battle with COVID-19. So Simon Sefcik's a Republican. He was appointed, but he had to run this last time around to do the job, to actually be elected to it for another term. And he lost. He ended up losing by about 1,000 votes. But I sat down with him at length for Future 42 to talk about just sort of his generation. I mean, 22 years old. And now he's obviously a very exceptional 22-year-old in terms of his involvement in politics and his knowledge of politics. But one of the things that we talked about on the Wednesday episode in the segment I played, we kind of talked about some social issues like abortion and gay marriage and other things that you know, the younger generation is sort of isn't interested in rehashing, right? But I also kind of wonder, you have this really interesting dynamic with the younger generation. Their entire lives, they have grown up in this uber heated, vitriolic, divided political climate. And it is something that goes into every facet of their lives. I mean, they're on their phones all the time. They see it. I mean, they see it on TV all the time. I think when a lot of us were younger, we had moments of peace and quiet from politics, and that's just not the case anymore. And so I kind of wanted to pick Simon's brain about whether the future, you know, future politicians, future voters, and Generation Z has an independent streak. Maybe if they're going to reach the point where they're like, neither of these political parties are interesting to us. They're both exhausting to us. And maybe they want to kind of be more independent minded. So I wanted to play another portion of that interview for our segment Fridays with Friends. Do you have a lot of friends who share your political beliefs?
Yeah, I do.
Do you have a lot of friends who are in their 20s?
Yeah, but I play video games with them. I don't necessarily like go to the gym with them. I don't necessarily like talk politics a ton. But I mean, yeah, I have, you know, and I think they're like, I want to be clear that as dreadful as it sometimes sounds about Generation Z, I think there are a lot of young people that actually, and actually, maybe this counters your point a little bit, but I think it adds a little bit of nuance. While it is true that the Republican Party is getting hit for sort of focusing on the culture war, the Democratic Party oftentimes sort of does the same by going to just absolutely crazy levels with sort of the pronoun nonsense or, you know, that sort of thing, to where like the average person is sort of, you know, when they feel like they're getting just forced all the time to buy into this gender ideology.
Even young people, you feel like?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, like they just want to, you know, go hang out with their friends, do sort of normal things, not being told that they're evil because they're white all the time or that they have to abide by, you know, their friends' pronouns. You know, I mean, just those sorts of things that I think really do sort of, even people that are fairly like apolitical, just they feel like the Democratic Party's gone way too far with some of those things.
Yeah, I am hoping sometimes when I'm on the, what is it, the TikTok? What is the other one? The Snap chat?
Yikes, this isn't. Snapchat.
Sometimes those videos,
TikTok,
they get posted to Facebook where I see it because I don't have the other apps. But I feel like, and maybe even younger than you, are having a little bit of a libertarian bend where they're just like, screw authority, like we're done with all this nonsense.
Yeah.
And so I'm kind of like an independent streak that I'm kind of watching and hoping that things get so, you know, their whole lives, they've grown up in this heated, awful political climate.
Yep.
And I'm hoping it kind of wears them out to the point where they're like, we need to start over or we need to rebel in some way.
Yes, I think that's very true. And yeah, I think there are a lot of young people that just feel tired on both sides of everything, but not tired in like that they want to entirely exit the system, but that they know they want something else, something different, even if they don't know exactly what that looks like yet. Although you did just remind me, another thing I have to complain about briefly is Republicans also sort of played themselves with all of the election integrity stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Terrible. I mean, you know, the amount of, you know, constituents in my district that, you know, told me sort of either beforehand or afterwards that they didn't vote because they know that the other side is cheating. I mean, there is not. And again, the funny thing to me is like, this is just something that entirely was the fault of the Republicans in that sense of like, you know, the easiest way to convince somebody not to vote in the first place is to try to convince them that the entire system is rigged, which is what we did to ourselves, yeah, and then stopped people from showing up to vote. And then in that case, the other side wouldn't even have to cheat theoretically because your own side isn't showing up enough. And so, you know, that was just another example of just shooting ourselves in the foot.
Yeah, it's self-destruction. And I said over and over, the only way for sure your ballot is not going to be counted is if you
don't vote.
Turn yep. it in. Like, even if you think they're going to cheat with it,
go ahead and vote
is
anyways.
Is that any worse than you leaving it on your counter? The outcome is the same.
Right. Like, what are you proving to them? You know, right. is the person rigging the election really looking and saying, oh, so, you know, that group didn't vote. They really got me. Yeah. No, you know, they're glad. They don't want you to vote. Yeah. You know, whenever you feed these sort of election things, every Democrat that watches that and listens to that gets very, very happy when yeah. we play ourselves with stuff like that.
100%. It just plays into it. I guess for people who are watching who are disappointed in the way that November turned out and who are wondering, I think rightfully so, what does the future look like for the Republican Party? Can they ever win a statewide office again? Can they ever take back the state house or the state senate? What would you say to people who are feeling a little frustrated and feeling a little like given up?
Well, first of all, I know how you feel. As somebody that poured my heart and soul into a race that came close but not close enough, I understand that sentiment. And to me, I think it's a reminder that things are not hopeless. I do not think we should give up in any sense. I think, you know, in fact, I've joked before, if I could run again right now, I probably would. Mm-hmm. But the question is, we have to be smarter and even more diligent than we were in the past. And, you know, I look all the time, Florida, even like 10 years ago, was more considered a blue state than it was a red state. And, you know, Florida's completely switched. And we're seeing, you know, Oregon is actually becoming a little bit more red. California is becoming a little bit
more
red.
The Republican almost won the governorship in Oregon. I was shocked.
Yeah, Republican, I actually thought Drazen might, you know, win. And I think a Republican seat flipped this year for a Republican against a Democrat in Oregon. And so we are seeing in some states, you know, that are getting more and more red. But I think we really do have to go back to sort of and you know what, maybe this isn't popular, this will get me in trouble, but you know, we need to have better candidates for the governorship than the Lauren Culps of the world.
Oh, I agree. You won't get in trouble here. I'm sorry, Lauren. I know we've had a fine relationship.
The packet's taken somewhere, you know, and, you know, that it plays well on the east side of the state, but you cannot win, you know, with a candidate like that in Washington. But I think this is definitely a moment where we have to do some real soul searching to determine what the future is. But all of the time, Democrats have flipped solid red Republican states, and Republicans have done it to other states as well. It may take decades, you know, step by step, brick by brick, calloused hand by calloused hand, but it can be done. But it will take a lot of different approaches, I think, than what we've had.
I think Simon Sefcik for governor 2042.
No. You can give it a go here in the next 2 years or 6 years, and we'll see how things go.
Yeah, I'll let you know how that goes. Well, my only question for you is, why are you so smart? Where does that come from? Like I said, I was just deep in partying in college at 22.
It was because I didn't discover those things like TikTok and Snapchat until later on in life. Yeah. So I got some baseline of intelligence before I let the rest of my life get wasted on social media and all those other things. But I don't think, you know, I think the best advice I've received all of this year actually came from the Lieutenant Governor, Denny Heck, you know, a Democrat who I think, you know, was elected. He told me at the age of 24 years old.
Oh, okay.
And really nice guy, even though we probably have our fair share of political disagreements. But the advice he gave me, he said, you have a very important job and you are not a very important person. And, you know, that's the way I try to look at this whole thing is, you know, and I'm about to go down to Olympia sort of for the final set while I'm before the term ends, basically. And to me, it's just I still pinch myself to say this is a really special opportunity, but it's not because I'm special. And, you know, I if anything I've come away from this experience, while I'm sad, it's just increased my natural curiosity for, you know, for the world, for so many things. You know, so I guess I reading good books and having good conversations, you know, has always served me well, I guess.
And that entire lengthy interview with Washington State Senator Simon Sefcik will be up on future42.org, and I'll make sure to post a link to it as well on Patreon and Locals. It's Friday. You know what that means. It's time for our segment, Florida Report, which we taped early this week because Miranda apparently thinks she can go camping on a Friday. But we had an interesting conversation about a few stories involving Ron DeSantis.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
Okay, a couple Ron DeSantis stories as we usually do, because why would we not? I learned something from you about Florida's law that I didn't know before. So when our governor, Jay Inslee, ran for president and got like 0.00001% of the vote, he kept his job as governor. And obviously, after he had to drop out of the presidential run, he continued to serve as governor. So right now in Florida, that wouldn't be the case if Ron DeSantis were to run for president.
No, as the law stands in Florida, if a sitting governor makes a public announcement that he's running for president, he can no longer be the governor. He has to resign from his post as governor. And then that leaves him kind of vulnerable if he happens to lose the race for presidency. He doesn't just get his governorship back, so he would be without a job. So that's kind of actually curious, because I didn't know that either about Florida law, which is very strange. Maybe it's prevented people from running in the past. I don't know.
I'm a little two minds about that, because it kind of, Jay Inslee, our governor, spent a ton of time on the campaign trail when he was running for president, when it's like, you have a state to run, dude. And so that bothered me a little bit. And so I understand the kind of desire to say, okay, pick one. Either you run for president or you're the governor of Florida. So I really don't, that's a tough one for me. But there's, The newly sworn in Florida Senate president says that she might be willing to change that law basically for DeSantis.
Yeah, I mean, she basically says that, you know, running for the president is a great, you know, it's a great honor to be able to do so. And if we have a governor that's qualified enough to do that, like, why not give him the opportunity to make that happen? So it sounds like the GOP leaders and the Florida legislature are all kind of agreeing that changing this law would make it a little easier for DeSantis to make that announcement and get started on that. But I'm with you, because, you know, it's kind of how I feel about sitting presidents campaigning. Like, you're going to spend half of your second term or your sitting term campaigning and not doing your job. It's a little strange to me. But with that said, as a governor, governors is like, you know, it's like president and, you know, governor. So like it gives you the best idea of what this person can do for the country, because they're showing you right now what they can do for a state. So it's sticky for me too, because I believe he's got a job to do, but if he can take his experience in the job that he currently has and apply it to the nation in a successful way, like, he should be allowed to do that without losing his job and commitment to the people of Florida. So it is a sticky one.
Yeah, and I think it depends for the individual, how well they're willing to balance the two. I thought Jay Inslee was gone way too often. We had done a calendar kind of search on him, because all those calendars for the governors are public record, and he was gone so much out of state. And so, I don't know. I also think if you're going to change the law, don't do it for like one man. I think this is clearly a little political, because it's Republicans in charge saying, let's change this because Ron DeSantis might run for president. So as long as it's not this back and forth thing, like, let's change it for DeSantis and then change it back. You know, it's like, decide what you think is appropriate and stick to it. Interesting, exactly. Though. Let's touch really quickly on, because it's a story people remember. So there was a prosecutor in Florida, the Hillsborough County State Attorney, who DeSantis suspended from his job because he had basically signed some pledges saying he wasn't going to enforce a couple Florida laws. And now they're in court?
Yeah, so basically he took DeSantis to court. Normally when this happens, they have the opportunity, the elected official that's been suspended by the governor has the opportunity to go to the Senate and ask for their job back. This guy decided to go take him straight to court, which actually took DeSantis' camp by surprise. I don't think they expected him to make such waves about it. But basically, there's just kind of like a push and a pull going on there where you have somebody who's kind of sworn to uphold the law and defend the law in a legal way, saying that he doesn't agree with it. And he signed something saying that he's not going to not only support it, but like go after criminals of this offense. And then, you know, this is state law. And so I think there's just like a clashing of the minds, a clashing of opinions, because he is an elected official. People obviously liked him enough to elect him for whatever his beliefs and his, you know, his political standpoints are. And I think he's just kind of holding very firm to that, to stay faithful to the people that elected him. But at the end of the day, all elected officials have to find a way to work together. And I feel like they probably could have skipped this whole thing and had a good meeting about ways that they could make this all work. And rather than create more discord and more controversy and conflict within a state that, you know, it seems very strong, but we still have our like our political oppositions, you know, but you see it right here unfolding in front of you. You have a local level official fighting against, you know, the person that runs the state on difference of opinions, I guess.
Yeah, I do agree that prosecutors, if you want to be a prosecutor, your job is to uphold the law. I mean, certainly you have to have priorities. You have to use your prosecutorial judgment. But in this case, he signed this pledge saying that he wouldn't enforce Florida's abortion ban as it was. And then also he signed a pledge saying he wouldn't prosecute anyone for providing gender affirming care to transgender patients, even though at the time he signed that, the state didn't have any criminal laws dealing with that. The state now has a criminal law in Florida that bans gender affirming treatment for minors. But that was approved after this prosecutor was suspended. I think I tend to agree with one of the sentiments you made, which is this is an independently elected official. I think the people who should remove him from office are the people who put him there if they don't think he's doing a good job. I don't like the idea of a governor going in. And apparently, gosh, I was reading this Politico article. Apparently, like, okay, so this is crazy. It is a little crazy. So the governor's public safety czar, Larry Keefe, walks into this guy's office with sheriff's deputies and demanded he leave immediately, which is like a scene out of Yellowstone to me. So it's weird. So I tend to kind of believe that I think prosecutors need to do their job, but I think the voters are the ones who should be responsible for removing someone who isn't doing their job.
It's true. And this isn't the first time that DeSantis has exercised this ability of the governor to remove an elected official. He actually removed the Broward County sheriff after Parkland happened because of his office's, you know, response to the Parkland shooting or lack thereof. So it's definitely within the governor's right to do so. But it, like you said, the governor also has to take into consideration that his constituents, the people that vote, also elected this person in for a reason. So there has to be some meeting of the minds before they start sending sheriffs in to just remove an elected official from their office.
Yeah, these are two tough DeSantis stories because I'm not trying to like walk the fence. I don't always have a strong opinion on every single thing. And with these, I can kind of see both sides of this argument. I do agree that it just sort of feels like unnecessary drama. Like it was done in a very dramatic fashion when maybe the two should have chatted it out a little bit. Changing gears, Jeff Bezos has suddenly decided he wants to give away like a majority of his fortune. And something you noticed. So first of all, this fund is called the Day One Families Fund. And it's obviously money from Jeff Bezos. And tell me what it's for, this specific fund.
This specific fund is, he's been giving money into this fund, giving away funds since 2018. The Day One Families Fund issues leaders across the whole nation and in addition to Puerto Rico to different like groups and, you know, companies and people who are doing like a lot of work within the community of homeless people and like young families that are facing like, you know, possible homeless situations. So every year since 2018, this group chooses a whole bunch of people or groups from around the country and gives them significant amounts of money to help them fight homelessness and poverty at local levels. And one group that received this in Miami was Chapman Partnership. Chapman Partnership is a really big organization down here that deals very specifically with homeless families. They not only find permanent housing for people, but they also find temporary housing, in addition to just resources for mental health, finding jobs, education, and et cetera. I actually used to do a little volunteer work for Chapman Partnership, but they're a really great, very organized group of people. So it was nice to see them get a nice chunk of change. They're going to get $5 million. Washington had two organizations that are going to get some funds as well. One of them is going to receive $5 million. The other one, about $600,000. And then also our hometown of Fargo, North Dakota has a group that's going to be receiving a little over $2 million to help fight homelessness. So it's kind of nice to see, you know, somebody very much giving back their enormous amounts of wealth to help people that are on the complete opposite spectrum of them, you know, find some resources.
Yeah. And all over, and I was looking at, I mean, you just named a couple, but I mean, all of the United States. And it also shows like how profound of a crisis homelessness is everywhere, not just in cities like Seattle. I mean, it's really bad in Seattle, but you hear about it a lot in Seattle and on the West Coast, but it's really an issue in so many places. What I thought was interesting about these awards and the Day One Families Fund, it's actually modeled after what has been a really successful program for homeless and struggling families in the Seattle area. It's called Mary's Place. And the vision of that was basically no child should sleep outside. And Mary's Place, as something that is run by, you know, not the government, has been very successful. And so I like to see private individuals supporting causes that they vetted rather than giving that money to the government to just squander on things that don't work. So I'm assuming Jeff Bezos hopefully did his research on these organizations and they're going to be good ones to use that money.
Yeah.
Okay. We had to end with this one because I'm sure everyone and their mother saw the lawsuit this week. A woman suing Velveeta cheese for, I think, false advertising. And shock of the century, the woman is from Florida.
Yep. A Florida woman is suing Kraft for $5 million, saying that Velveeta shells and cheese takes longer to prepare than the packaging claims. So I read through some of the statements from the lawsuit, and it basically says that the 3.5 minutes is only like taking in consideration cook time. It's not taking in consideration the amount of time it takes to peel the lid off, put water in, stir it, add the cheese, then you cook for 3.5 minutes, and then you have to let it sit so that the cheese can thicken. So she says it's false advertising. Let me tell you.
This chick needs a job.
As much as she's right, like she's right, but this is as frivolous gets when it comes to lawsuits. And I do believe there's some laws out there that prevent frivolous lawsuits from wasting everybody's time. And Kraft did respond calling it a frivolous lawsuit. And so we'll see where this goes. See if she actually gets any money for this. Or if anybody's entitled, like maybe she should just be one of those class action things where they're like, if you purchased Velveeta shells, like we'll give you a free one and with the right cook time on it.
Like if you starved to death in the extra 30 seconds it took you to make the Velveeta shells, which are delicious, by the way.
They are.
But leave it to a Florida woman. I think she just needs a job.
She does. Right. Maybe her job is to find these loopholes though and just take companies to the bank for it.
It's a sad existence. Miranda, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Good to see you.
And you're going camping this weekend?
I am going camping this weekend. It was rescheduled, our trip, from that last random hurricane that hit Florida a few weeks back. So we're going to go out. It's a little colder, so it'll be a much more refreshing camping trip. So I'm not mad about it.
No one here wants to hear about you being cold in Florida. Just don't let the alligators get you.
Okay, I won't.
Okay, bye.
It's not even controversial anymore.
People know in Florida their freedoms are going to be respected.
I hate to say this. Elon Musk is really ticking me off today. I'm an Elon Musk fan, but, you know, sometimes he's just kind of a mess. So I tease kind of earlier on. So Elon Musk tweets out, what time to do this? He said, What really happened with the Hunter Biden story suppression by Twitter will be published on Twitter at 5 p.m. Eastern time. We'll include live Q&A. So 5 p.m. Eastern time is 2 p.m. Pacific time. And just a little behind the scenes of the show, we try to tape it as late as we can, and still we aim for posting at 5 p.m. So like right now it's 4:12. I waited as long as I can to see what Elon Musk would say about this. Hope and get it in, but so, and this is a huge announcement, right? What really happened with the Hunter Biden story suppression by Twitter will be published on Twitter at 5 p.m. Eastern time. So I'm like, oh God, we got to wait for that. That's crazy. It's got like 100,000 retweets and 500,000 likes. Well, you know, 2 p.m. Pacific time comes and goes and nothing. I'm like, oh, maybe they're just a couple of minutes late. Well, now it's been 2 hours. One more thing he says. So this was an hour after it was supposed to be this big bombshell. He says, we're double checking some facts, so probably we'll start live tweeting in about 40 minutes. Why would you not double check facts before you tell the whole world and your 119 million followers that you're going to be putting this out at 5 p.m. Eastern time? Like, don't you think by the time you make that announcement about something so big and serious that you would have double checked your facts? So I'm just a little bit like, come on, Elon, you're a really, really smart guy. Like, maybe he just got ahead of himself or ahead of his team. So the only thing he sent out as of this recording is he retweeted Matt Taibbi, who is like an author. He's done some journalism. I'm not sure what he does right now. But so Elon Musk retweeted him and said, here we go with some popcorn. And so I'm thinking, oh, so Matt Taibbi's got this exclusive. So Matt Taibbi sends out this thread and he calls it the Twitter files. And it is, don't get me wrong, there is some interesting stuff in here, but I don't think, like, I'm waiting, what more are they going to do? What more is going to come? So I want to read a little bit, and he's adding to this, like, by the minute, this Twitter thread. So Matt Taibbi says he's got this information from sources within Twitter. He says, what you're about to read is the first installment in a series based upon thousands of internal documents obtained by sources at Twitter. The Twitter files tells an incredible story from inside one of the world's largest and most influential social media platforms. It is a Frankensteinian tale of a human-built mechanism grown out of the control of its designer. He goes on to say, Twitter in its conception was a brilliant tool for enabling instant mass communication, making a true real-time global conversation possible for the first time. In an early conception, Twitter more than lived up to its mission statement, giving people the power to create and share ideas and information instantly without barriers. As time progressed, however, the company was slowly forced to add those barriers. Some of the first tools for controlling speech were designed to combat the likes of spam and financial fraudsters. Slowly, over time, Twitter staff and executives began to find more and more uses for these tools. Outsiders began petitioning the company to manipulate speech as well, first a little, then more often, then constantly. So Matt Taibbi in this thread, based on these internal Twitter documents, is painting this story of sort of how Twitter went from this platform for free speech and the instant sharing of information to being something that was really overregulated and often in an unfair way politically. So this brings us back to the Hunter Biden laptop story. So this was a story that was broke by the New York Post in 2020 that the mainstream media just refused to cover and labeled a conspiracy. So much so that Twitter suppressed it on its platform. You could not share the New York Post story. Remember this? You could not share that story, that link to that New York Post article on Twitter. And then, of course, you fast forward 2 years and the mainstream media now confirms the New York Post reporting. So now it's not a conspiracy anymore. So Matt Taibbi is releasing right now as we speak some of these internal documents that shows the extent to which the Biden team in the lead up to the 2020 election was forcefully suggesting that Twitter suppress this story and this information. So, for instance, in an internal email sent on October 24th within Twitter, it says more to review from the Biden team. And it has links to some Twitter posts that the Biden team wants reviewed and potentially taken down. It also has an email that says, these are reports from the DNC, where the DNC is giving Twitter direct access to Twitter to remove tweets that they want removed. Now, at the same time, Matt Taibbi does say that both political parties had this sort of direct access to Twitter, that the Trump White House in 2020 was also sending requests into Twitter. But they say that it wasn't balanced because it was based on kind of your ability to have internal contacts at Twitter. Matt Taibbi says, because Twitter was and is overwhelmingly staffed by people of one political orientation, there were more channels and more ways to complain that were open to the left as opposed to the right. He goes on to say, the resulting slant in content moderation decisions is visible in the documents you're about to read. However, it's also the assessment of multiple current and former high-level executives. So then he gets into, and I think you need to go to Matt Taibbi's Twitter account, Taibbi's Twitter account, to kind of read into this. But now he's getting into, and this is happening in real time, how and why Twitter blocked the Hunter Biden laptop story. So he gives a little bit of the background saying, you know, October 14th, 2020, the New York Post published Biden secret emails, which was an expose based on the contents of Hunter Biden's abandoned laptop. He goes on to say Twitter took extraordinary steps to suppress the story, removing links and posting warnings that it may be unsafe. They even blocked its transmission via direct message. So, for instance, Twitter only uses that kind of tool for like child pornography, saying that it can, you know, if you're sending a DM that's private to the rest of the world, it still knows that that's an image of child pornography. So Twitter even went as far as to prevent me from sending a New York Post story on this New York Post story to a friend privately because it identified that link. Matt Taibbi goes on to say, White House spokeswoman Kayleigh McEnany was locked out of her account for tweeting about the story, prompting a furious letter from Trump campaign staffer Mike Hahn, who seethed at Twitter that they should at least pretend to care for the next 20 days. So when that happened and Kayleigh McEnany's account was suspended and the Trump camp reached out to Twitter like WTF, there were some internal deliberations happening behind the scenes at Twitter. Matt Taibbi has these emails. And in one of them, a Twitter analyst says that the user, Kayleigh McEnany, was bounced by site integrity for violating our hacked materials policy. So they're basically saying we have a policy against publishing hacked materials. They believed that the Hunter Biden laptop story was a result of hacking. Matt Taibbi goes on to say, although several sources recalled hearing about a general warning from federal law enforcement that summer about possible foreign hacks, there's no evidence of any government involvement in the laptop story. He quotes a former employee saying they just freelanced it. Hacking was the excuse, but within a few hours, pretty much everyone realized that wasn't going to hold, but no one had the guts to reverse it. So Twitter had made this decision based on what is probably a false premise that this information was obtained via hacking. And then within a few hours, when it became clear that that was ridiculous, and also I don't think hacking, material gained via hacking, means it's not newsworthy. Certainly you don't want to elevate or encourage hacking, but we're talking about, at that time, the presidential candidate's son and what ties they might have to foreign entities. So then you have this mass freakout on Twitter, kind of like, we've already made this decision and we just have to stick with it, and stick with it they did. So as I said, this is happening really in real time. And Matt Taibbi is tweet by tweet detailing some of the quote unquote Twitter files he has that explains. And this is, I believe, at the behest of Elon Musk. I mean, Elon Musk said that he believes in order for Twitter to restore trust with people that have lost faith in it, that they need to release these internal deliberations about these controversial decisions like the New York Post story. which I think is a great idea. We'll see what else comes of it, but that's what we know at this moment. All this information is coming out, flooding out this evening. I'm sure it'll continue over the weekend. And so I know that this is a story we're going to talk about again on Monday. New York City has a proposal that is, I got to be honest, it's one I'm really torn about. And it's this idea of sort of the general good of the public versus individual liberties. So New York City has an issue with homelessness and mental health, and very much so in the Seattle area, Portland, in a lot of places in California. I think it's the same thing. You have people who call it a homelessness issue. It's not. It's a mental health crisis, and it's also fueled by a drug epidemic. One of the challenges in Washington State is you can't just say, oh, you're mentally ill and we're going to put you in a hospital and you have to stay there. We have, you know, individual liberties, right? And I think in a lot of ways, it's a very, very good thing. There's a court process you have to go through to initially get an involuntary commitment and then to continue to extend an involuntary commitment. And in Washington State, if you are walking on the street, and this happens a lot in downtown Seattle, and you see someone who's clearly mentally ill, police aren't just going to, like, take that person and bring them to a hospital. There's a higher standard there. Like, are they doing something? Are they breaking the law? Are they doing something dangerous? Or are they just being mentally ill in public, for lack of a better, I'm just trying to be as blunt as I can. Well, in New York City, Mayor Eric Adams essentially says, we have a city, have a duty and a responsibility to take care of these people if they can't take care of themselves. And so what he has proposed is using the existing laws and kind of a broader definition of the circumstances under which outreach workers in New York City and police officers in New York City are able to intervene in an involuntary fashion. So let me play just really quickly so you can hear from Mayor Eric Adams when he came out and made this announcement. And I'll offer sort of some thoughts on it.
I want to talk to you about a crisis we see all around us. People with severe and untreated mental illness who live out in the open, on the streets, in our subways, in danger, and in need. We see them every day, and our city workers are familiar with their stories. The man standing all day on the street across from the building he was evicted from 25 years ago, waiting to be let in. The shadow boxer on the street corner in Midtown, mumbling to himself as he jabs at an invisible adversary. The unresponsive man unable to get off the train at the end of the line without his assistance from our mobile crisis team. These New Yorkers and hundreds of others like them are in urgent need of treatment, yet often refuse it when offered. The very nature of their illnesses keeps them from realizing they need intervention and support. Without that intervention, they remain lost and isolated from society, tormented by delusions and disordered thinking. They cycle in and out of hospitals and jails. But New Yorkers rightly expect our city to help them, and help them we will.
So New York State has what's called a mental hygiene law, which is an interesting name for it. But it basically says that if you have someone who appears to be mentally ill and they are acting in a way that could result in serious harm to themselves or to other people, that you can take them in to a hospital or a psychiatric facility involuntarily for an evaluation. But Eric Adams in the city of New York, there was a memorandum issued by the State Health Department in February that seemed to kind of interpret the existing law differently. And it allows for, quote, the removal of a person who appears to be mentally ill and also displays an inability to meet basic living needs, even when no recent dangerous act has been observed. And so that sounds like if you've got someone who's, say, homeless and they're living in squalor or whatever it is, and there's good reason to believe that they're mentally ill, that you don't have to wait until they're a danger to themselves or others in the traditional sense, that you can, as a police officer, with the help of social workers, you can take them to a hospital or a psychiatric facility involuntarily. And so this is where you get into this idea of individual liberty. which I struggle with in a lot of different ways. You know, for instance, libertarians, they think that people should be able to use drugs if they want to. I disagree with that because you don't just use drugs in a closed, locked up room in a silo. Drug use often has consequences for people who are not using drugs, be it that person's family, be it violence, be it stealing to support your drug habit. So I think legalizing drugs, which is a libertarian perspective, has so many negative negative consequences for society. And so I kind of look at this situation the same way, and I tend towards supporting what New York City is doing. Because we have not made any progress on our mental health crisis in Washington state. And you have people who are severely mentally ill, who are encountering the criminal justice system dozens, if not in some cases, 100 times. I'm reminded of a case in Seattle where there was a guy who, you know, had on multiple occasions just randomly attacked people in downtown Seattle. One time he threw coffee on a baby. And then it's like you just get cycled in and out of this system. But, you know, that's people who commit crimes. You do have a lot of people who it's devastating. It's tragic. They're clearly mentally ill. And they clearly, per this New York City observation, display an inability to meet basic living needs, which I think is a threat to themselves. If you are mentally ill, you're living in squalor, that's a threat to your health, that's a threat to your safety. And so what New York City is saying is, hey, even if that person's not out there, you know, waving their arms around and harassing strangers in downtown Seattle, we can still do something about it. And we can take them in involuntarily for a mental health evaluation. I tend to be okay with that. I think the question is, what is the basis for how long you can keep them involuntarily committed? What are you going to do to help them once they get there? One of the kind of challenging lines I think you try not to cross on this issue is giving a person's family, for instance, too much power without interference from a judge or without oversight from a judge, to just involuntarily commit a loved one. Like, oh, hey, granny, who's a millionaire. Oh, yeah, I'm sorry, but you're not well mentally, and I'm going to put you in an institution. We don't want to get to that point, right? You do have to have oversight. You do have to have clear boundaries, and you do have to have a process that you follow. But I'm interested to see how this goes in New York City. You know, New York City is doing way better than Seattle when it comes to getting people off the street and into shelter. They have a right to shelter law, which is a big part of that. But this is something that I think Seattle needs to seriously look at. And I don't know if we have the resources to do it in terms of workers on the ground and police officers. But if you can, and part of it is showing compassion. This is a person who probably can't make a decision for themselves to help themselves. So do we as a society say, okay, we recognize that we're going to try to make this decision for you to get treatment and to get help? I'd be really curious what you guys think about this and sort of where is that line between for the public good and personal rights and liberty and freedom. So send me your comments on it, post on Patreon or Locals, and then I'll read some of those comments on the Monday episode. All right, that's it for today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your continuing commitment to give common sense a comeback. I appreciate every single one of you. I had a lot of fun on the subscriber Q&A on Wednesday. Thanks to those of you who joined. Always great to sit and answer your questions for a little bit. All right, newsletter out on Sunday morning as usual, and I'll see all of you on Monday.